Parkcast, the UK's original theme park podcast.
Welcome back to Parkcast, park fans. We are a podcast for theme park fans. We absolutely love talking about theme parks, and we're here every week doing just that. I'm Bex. I'm joined by Kev and Kip, and this is part two of our interview with Francis Jackson. Francis, of course, the former operations director and general manager at the Alton Towers Resort, now back in Australia, and he's been joining us to talk all things theme park operations. If you've missed part one of this podcast, it's available to listen to now, and I really recommend you go and have a listen to that first. We've talked about ride downtime, winter strips, answered some of our questions about theme park operations as well. We're going to jump right back in. At the end of the first episode, we were talking about staffing and how that impacted theme park's ability to operate. So I asked him if it was a challenge to retain staff in the theme park industry.
Definitely a challenge when I was there initially. It's a challenge regardless. And it's a challenge that I found not only just in the ski industry, but also in the attraction industry. Is you would struggle because people at home would say, when are you going to get a real job?
Yeah.
That's a really big one. So it's really hard when you've got, on one side you feel it, then in the home environment you feel it. So there's a lot of good operators should have very sound practices, really good processes, and really good communication, and to make your team feel welcome, and that there is a pathway, there is a career progression within that space, and it is valued, and the world is bigger than just your own attraction. There is an industry that sits around us, and it's a global industry. And that it can provide for those that aspire to go up that. But not just that, the industry itself provides great service, customer excellence, individuals that come out of it, great maintenance. Every industry is represented here, from your marketing teams, your hotel teams, you know, your food and beverage, your retailers, every aspect of it. So you can come out of this with really, really good experience. Mm. And there's really good opportunities to be able to explore different paths. On what you may or may not like. You know, you may start off in retail, but you could end up in health and safety. You could end up in engineering. And so I think it is a challenge to give people that confidence, to be able to articulate it, to display that. And when I arrived, I had to create some very, we developed some programs that started to demonstrate how strong the career path was, and that it was achievable. But in industries like this, you can also find that people at the top don't move often, and therefore those underneath move away because they can't see career progression. So you have to be conscious of that. But it is a challenge, but that flees all the way back. Why? Why am I here? For what reason? Why is the customer relevant to me? Here's the message. I'm just turning it over and pushing it out. Whereas when you give people a sense of purpose, then they start to understand why they're there, and then they can start to understand the delivery. So if I go back and talk about the viewpoint I have on whether an individual is the face of the business versus the brand, what you really want is the brand piece, and then you want these satellite customer service agents enhancing the experience of everyone's day. Even when you make mistakes as a business, and sometimes the mistakes are sometimes out of your control because they conspire against you. Like I said, get a number of rides break down at the same time, but you need the right message to come out, and that comes through training, experience, depth. And if the teams are young, when I say young, not so much in age, but if they're young in terms of experience, you find that the business defaults to the lowest common denominator. Like we all do in a stressful environment, we revert to our worst type. People, the first thing we train everybody is on safety. The next layer becomes the service level. And if you're under pressure, you sometimes default back to that point. It's not what the customer wants.
We've all stood there getting frustrated. It's interesting though, because we've done an episode with Neil Dwyer, who's the VP of operations over there at Six Flags Qiddiya, which is going to open. And he says the same thing, you know, exactly the same as what you're saying, you know, as another operations director, that getting your staff to feel valued, that's his major focus, is making sure that his teams feel that way and feel happy, because he knows that's how he's going to get his park to run effectively.
Absolutely. It's smooth. So one of the things we haven't really touched on, and this is when you're bringing, I'll talk about an age ride. So In my experience, I always felt that it would take us about for the staff to be really efficient on deck on the platforms, right? Particularly on your big coasters where you'd have six, eight staff, right? It would take us, six to eight staff. You're running a rota that's somewhere in the order of 45 people. When you run it through a 7-day week rota, and then they cross train and work on different rides as well, in hubs. You would need about 6 weeks before that team gels. So if you think about what's the best example I can use? It's like a sporting team when you put them together. See the really young kids when you put them together and they all run around like a gaggle and eventually, actually less in the UK, it's not a good example because you all watch football and I've never seen so much structure for young kids when they play football as opposed to here in Australia, it's like a mob on the ball when at football. But it's like it's like that. It's like a really well-oiled professional sporting team, right? It takes about 6 weeks to where everything becomes second nature. Intuitively, everybody knows what's going to happen. When the operator says we've got a stoppage here, everybody knows what to do. They've already got their roles. And to keep people engaged, like Neil would say, like I've been saying, right? We want to rotate people through job functions because we don't want to become bored and disengaged and then take their eye off the ball and forget to do a check. Right, like a lap bar check, and so you're rotating people every 30 minutes through the different roles, so they're constantly moving around, and then you get a stoppage. So what the job you were doing before is now not the job you're doing on the same stoppage. Does that make sense? And how to get everybody to a point where it's intuitive, it's a challenge. And then you've got your midweek team, and it's almost like you've got a weekend team, just on the way things work, And so it's really hard. So for the first 6 weeks, not only have you got your ride's giving you headache from a technical perspective, right? And a challenge and delays. You've got a maintenance team that's working out a new ride and they don't know all the nuances of it. And it takes them a while to work it out. You've got a rides team that feels like it's a really, it's a grade two theater team on stage. It's clunky, it's awkward, it feels kooky, yeah. Before you get to that point, I always used to hope that by Easter we had a pretty well-oiled machine. But when you talk about a big new ride, it's not just like it's a team. This is like the entire organization of a sporting team, like the whole team of Manchester United from the CEO down, everyone getting ready for the next season. That's what a new ride's like, a big coaster, because everyone's involved now. Marketing's involved. You've got your branded merchandise, you've got your themed food, your hotel's got themed rooms. Do you know what I mean? Your ticketing products, you got all this stuff. Everybody is getting ready for the big season as opposed to just a sporting team. And this has a really big impact on how rides operate, them sorting themselves out and finding their place and their niche and the years of experience that that operator has and that level of calmness that they can have in those times when it's challenging.
Did you ever have one of those experiences where you felt that those moments that you're describing?
Wanting to hide. I mean, your heart's bleeding. Your heart's bleeding for the guest experience. All right. But the biggest thing you can do is keep the team calm and you've got to give them support. You've got to have visible leadership and show them that you're there with them in the fire and get them back on, make sure they're on task. And you can't unpick it yourself. You need your team to unpick this and work your way through it. And just keep moving, it's that's all you can do is give that team support. You've got to make them feel valued and know that management are there, management have got their back because later in the season you can't always be there. What you want is for them to know that you've been there and you've told them work through the problems, solve it together as a cohesive unit, Don't stress about the fact that the ride is down because I used to say this, go slow to go fast. If you want to be quick, we've got to go slow. Just don't miss a check. Don't do this. Work through the process. And it actually is quicker, even though it feels like forever at the time. And communicate, to the guest, it's a really clear thing.
Obviously we've talked quite a bit about ride downtime. I want to touch on something else shortly, but just before we do that, one of the things that I got told, and I'd like you to like maybe confirm or deny this, is that rides are getting more downtime now because they are more complex. But even from like Nemesis to Wicker Man, say, Is Wicker Man any more complex in terms of ride sensors and stuff like that than Nemesis?
That's specifically to the Alton rides and those two you mentioned. It's interesting. I would have said there's probably a bit more going on the Wicker Man. You know, you've got the Wicker Man himself. You've got the various effects and the animatronics that exist in that space. You've got the pre-show and all the pieces that are going on into that. You've got the timing with that and then into the ride. And I think that one's probably got quite, and the timings that with the ride craft, that one's probably got more on it than I would say that NEMI does. Although NEMI would have had a complete system upgrade and therefore sensor upgrade and everything like that, and it had a new train, so all of its procs and limit switches would have been done at the same time. I think one of the ones that you look at where you want to draw a really strong contrast would be against, say, Alton Matter at Alton. You look at that ride, that's probably where you're talking. I mean, indoor dark ride is heavy, right? On an aged ride, but new immersive theming and lighting effects, all the special effects that are associated with that. There's a real balance in a business. And I talked about before with an aeroplane. An aeroplane makes a decision to take off. They go through the maintenance checklist and they go, right, we can afford to take off with three toilets not working. All right. And they make that call. And we can afford to take off with this not working and that not working. All right. Indoor rides, you do the same sort of thing. You go, we can afford to operate today, but without that stuff working. All right. But there'll be some key features where you go, we can't open today because of that. So there's nothing wrong with the ride. I could put you in the ride, you go around and you'd get the 80%, but it's detracting from the immersive experience. And it's a really hard balance when you're crying out for a ride that can deliver you 1,000 plus an hour more. And your park's full and you've got other rides and you go, my God, there's nothing wrong with a ride, but the experience is gonna be diminished significantly, and it's holding true to your values as a business of what you stand for, what it is you're trying to do. And so it goes back to this is where we draw the line on what we call the minimum experience we want. And you're making a balancing act there. And like all of these things, sometimes it's out for a couple of hours. Sometimes you're going, right, so we haven't got it for 10 days. What do we do? Do we forge ahead? And that goes back to your critical spares, and that goes back to your design before the ride even starts. Are you carrying all the parts? Have you got everything there? Have you gone through and found all those single points of failure? So.
Curse of Alton Man is an interesting one because I remember when it opened, it wouldn't operate if certain effects were down because they wanted you to get the experience.
Yeah, I was
But
part of that.
recently
I
we've
was part of
noticed
that.
there's, oh, fantastic. I mean, recently we've seen a lot of effects go down, and it has carried on running despite certain things going down. And I think as enthusiasts we get picked on for
Well,
caring too
that would.
much, but it's like you say, it kind of does diminish the experience you get if a lot of effects are down and it's still going.
In a balancing act, you're probably staring at that versus the entire attraction, and you're going, if I've got something else that's down or more, and this one works, and it's a balancing act between what do you give versus where do you hold the line, and how do you manage your values, and all of this comes back down to those strategic factors. You know, what are you carrying in spare parts? Who's trained? Do you have the right personnel who can make the changes? What are your minimums? So I can only speculate, and I'd rather not go any deeper other than to say there's probably challenges in a way where they're making balanced decisions against the value set of what they consider the minimum in order to keep something open versus what else is open in the wider place. And that's a challenge. And I have been there before in that space. And I think every operator who's worked with aged assets understands that balance. And it's a fine line between and it's versus what you truly want to do versus what the guest experience is. And it's tough, and many attractions will have had that balance, just how deep and how hard you want to go and how hard you want to stay true to what you set out as one of the objectives. But I think there's new and old rides. You know, when you look at like this the rise of what we call continuous improvement, have you heard of things like Kaizen, the Japanese Kaizen, Lean, they call it Six Sigma? There's all these continuous improvement frameworks and methodologies, and continuous improvement and maintenance practices over the last few years within the industry has been moving towards what they call sort of condition-based maintenance. And then subsequently predictive maintenance. So predictive, we're predicting it's going to happen, so we change it out before it gets there. So condition-based maintenance, okay? It's really hard if you've got an electric motor, and when that first went on the ride, if you don't have the measurement about what its maximums are, what it can do, what its outputs are, what its resistance is, when you're trying to do condition-based maintenance, what that does is it tells you that if that was the baseline and it's now dropped to here, the likelihood is that that motor will stop at some point, and therefore you can change that out before it happens. Okay. But if you don't have that baseline, it's very hard to sort of predict when it's going to happen in order to change it out before it happens. All right. And that helps with your budgets and managing that. So it basically, once you get into that space, you can start to set schedules that say, look, we'll rebuild this every 500 hours. Right. Instead of getting to 700 hours and discovering it fails. And then it's like the failure means you can't even get replacement parts. But if you can rebuild it every 500, you can get things done. And parks are starting to increasingly use this is aged parks as opposed to brand new, but even new ones come with this stuff now more. Sensors, if you increasingly using sensors and real-time data to monitor those actual condition of the components to predict this before it happens. Vibration sensors could be fitted on like the lift hill of the mountain to detect abnormal readings in vibration, and maintenance can intervene before a motor burns out during operation. You know, the goal is to fix this stuff in a convenient time in advance rather than reacting after a breakdown. And if an attraction slides into reactive maintenance, right, it's incredibly hard to climb back out of that hole. It's very easy to get there, really hard to get back out. And so this shift everyone's trying to climb into, should be trying to climb into, just improves your reliability and availability. And that helps. So I think when you see parks in general with challenging downtime, you're looking at a space where it's probably more reactive than it is planned. And they either are or are not, but trying to climb out of that space. And it's just not an overnight switch. This is quite a journey. It's an educational journey too. And it requires a really strategic plan to balance out the old and the new. And you've got to perform, you know, you've still got to perform your mandatory inspections and your preventive maintenance, often by law or by the manufacturer, while adding in or integrating sensor data and predictive analytics into your workflow streams within all your software systems and your parts systems. The payoff is huge if you can get there. But you've got to have, it's a strategic decision and it's a philosophy in how you go about approaching it. So it's not just something the technical team does, it's how a business thinks and operates and wants to strive. Yeah, I think new parks would be great. Aged parks come with real challenges, and I had the same challenge in ski with old rides, old lifts. So there was nothing different at Alton that I hadn't experienced in ski. Those were still the same challenges, just with different equipment.
Yeah, you wouldn't think it would be similar, but clearly it is.
Same thing.
This is something we've talked about a lot. Apart from downtime, staggered openings are something we're seeing more and more in the UK. Is there a good operational reason for a staggered opening, or is it purely a cost thing?
I'll tell you what staggered opening does do. All right. And you can probably work it out from there. Okay. When you look at the way in which visitors come into a park, I'll pick a number for the sake of picking a number here today. All right. Because I will never divulge actual numbers. Let's say your park's maximum visitation was 8,000 a day. Okay. And you open at 10 o'clock, right? And you're going to be full that day and you've sold 8,000 tickets. 8,000 people don't come through the gate at 10:01. So it takes, you know, that's a design of your security bag check and turnstile procedure. They're probably churning through 2,500 an hour, 3,000 an hour. So you can probably move everybody in. And most parks open a little bit earlier, the front gate. So you're moving people on. So over the course of about a 2 hour window, 2 and a bit hours, you move everybody in to the park. And what's happening here is a thought pattern that says, right, if for the first hour I've only got 4,000 people here, And that's a maximum of 4,000 because that's how many they can let through the front gate. For the first half an hour, I can only have 2,000. Well, therefore, do I need to have opened every single ride? That's the basics, all right? That's just really simple. And if you drew a curve on a map, you would go, right, here it goes. It goes up to maximum. And at 12 o'clock, 11:30, quarter to 12, everyone's on the park. And that holds true. And then at 1 o'clock, you start to see tail end Charlies. Those will come for a second day, right? Those, 2 or 3 o'clock, depending on what your closing time is. Say you've got a 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock closing time, you're probably running pretty full. And
I
then,
wish.
yeah, we wish. So what happens is the mindset says, well, I'll pinch that because not every ride's going to be full. I'm going to be sending trains with empty seats, right? And you don't go, well, we'll just add another train on, because to add another train on 11 o'clock, right, you got to pull your maintenance team off whatever they're doing, right? And then they've got to go put a train on. The train takes like 30 minutes, 25 minutes to put a new train on, put it through its cycles, restart it all, sign off the book, and away you go. So maintenance wants to know what you're putting on at the start of the day before you get there. Bang, you throw everything on. All right, and away you go. So to do that, what you're saying is, okay, for the first hour, let's open 75% of the park. Everyone can go and do that. But what it's doing, okay, is it's robbing you of your rides that you can achieve in a single day. So the industry measures, we measure things like how many rides the guest got per day, rides per head. How many rides did the guest get? All right. There's no secret in that. That's a pretty standard metric used in the attraction industry. All right. Planes use it. Passenger load frequency is in airlines. And so what you got is, you've got people queuing. So if you had, in a theoretical world, if you said, right, let's open 50% of the rides for 4,000 people in the first hour, everyone's still queuing with a 40-minute queue. And then when you get to 8,000, you've got all the rides open. Well, you've still got your 40-minute queue, if that's what 40-minute queues mean. You know, when you've got eight full park, 40-minute queues, you wish, et cetera, et cetera. So what happens, all right, is you've been robbed, and it's the wrong word. You are denied your ability to go bang, 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 bang. And in that first hour, poach four rides because they're effectively empty or 10-minute queues. And when you look at the total sum of your rides for the day, what happens is you are three rides less than what you would have had because you had to queue when you've, does that make sense? You've queued for a longer period of time on the less rides. Now, depending on which rides have been taken out, et cetera, for that period of time. So that's ultimately what happens is your rides per head goes down. So there is inevitably a savings in cost that comes because you haven't had to start that. So that could be, and so while that's a natural outcome, the question becomes is, well, real savings is occurred when you do it on large rides where you have lots of team members, rather than rides that have one or two members. All right. And if you weigh that up against the balance between customer service, you're more likely to go, okay, who's in the gate straight away? Enthusiasts, we should open the big ones, but you don't get a big cost saving. But what you may find is that there's a staggered opening that sits with the maintenance team. So how do you get a maintenance team to open 31 rides simultaneously? It's a challenge. And what time can they start? So when you look at the industrial relation laws, a term used in the UK, the laws that govern when your team can start, they will be negotiated. All right. Sometimes those start times aren't allowing you early enough as your rides age, as you continuously improve through audits and checks, and you increase your checks, all right, to improve your standard of safety on this continuous improvement. You find that if you can stagger one or two rides a bit later, then you can allow for the engineering team to move through the different rides and get to them in time to hand them over to the operation team. Now, some rides operations need for 15 minutes, some rides operations need them for 45 minutes to go through and do their own checks as well. All right. So this is balancing. So everyone's under pressure because someone's got to deliver it to the next person, and operations has to deliver it to the customer through the advertised time. So if, and there were some balancing acts, like we used to say at Alton, it's like we noticed when we opened everything at 10 o'clock there was very few people riding the rapids run. So when the decision was made, it was before my time, to have that one always open at 11. And you know what? I challenged that notion, and it actually made sense because there was just no one riding it. Like people would rather get on other stuff first. Like they wanted to go bang, 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 bang. But Smiley gets smashed, Nemi gets hit, Wicker Man gets hit. You know, they were just like the things. I mean, you just watched them, you know, what was going to get targeted first. And then everyone sort of had their path. So you have a balance. But then if your total visitation's down as well across the year, then you're probably looking for savings. So there's this balance between is it cost saving, or is it to support a maintenance team that may have seen a higher turnover, that therefore they still have the same headcount or increased headcount, but the total competency that's trained out within the team doesn't allow for all of that? Because, you know, if you've gone from having, you know, 80 engineers and 65 were competent and 15 were sort of apprentices, and the balances were shifted to 40-40, right? Then you're relying on half your workforce, not 6, 75, 85% of your workforce, and that therefore slowing down sign off in the morning. And things that change sign off is like you know, in the old hat days, you know, a competent engineer would sign off a ride and then keep going. Nowadays, we want two people to sign it off. We want someone to check that when he's signing it off, when someone measures the thickness of the brake fin, we want someone to double check that that measurement was correct as well. But yeah, I think there'll be underlying. I can't speak for any site because I don't know everybody's site currently. But if you would probably say, you know, for a while there, you know, there's probably some truths that are thought are probably real, but I can only speculate.
You mentioned the rapids. That is one of the ones that is still obviously on a staggered opening.
People didn't really like getting too wet at the start of the year or right at the very end when it was cold. You know, no one likes walking around Alton wet. It's horrible. It's a horrible experience. But in the heat of summer, yeah. Like, I mean, depends how you flex it, and it depends what the overall challenges. And that's what makes it really interesting is there are so many factors. Right, there are so many factors that go into these decisions that you make, whether they're reactive and in the moment, whether they're just for a short period of time, or whether they're for the whole season that they're baked in, you know, whether it's around whether your team. So we talked on it earlier. Looking after your team is really critical, and so sometimes you need to pull back. Yeah, I said you can see a year out what's going to happen on winter maintenance. You can see a year out what's going to happen on operations the following year too. And if that means if that's the case, then you know, you could probably say there'll be cost challenges or the team has had high churn, which you then start to go, what's going on? Why is the team leaving? What's going on? What's causing the rot that people are leaving? And that's harming their capability. So there's an underlying reason in each of these challenges. Why aren't more visitors coming? If there's a drop in visitation to a theme park or an amusement park, then there has to be a knock-on somewhere in the operations costs. So why aren't people coming? That comes back down to your leadership and your strategic plan. Now, ultimately, great leadership creates a culture where everyone's proactive about mitigating issues before they impact the guest. It's having a radar for those problems and addressing them in advance. It's also about balance, pushing for excellence, and caring for your team. And for me, a team that is supported will support the mission wholeheartedly.
For you personally, what was it you enjoyed the most while you were at Alton Towers and doing your role here?
It's at the end of the day, it's all about people, be it the team or be about the guests. It's all about people having a good time and enjoying themselves. You know, for the team, they get to meet lots of new people. It's a great way to socialize. I've experienced multi generations in the one workplace because they've enjoyed it so much, and that's a testament to the management team and the environment, and also the customers to putting a smile on people's face. That's the thing. So, you know, Alton Towers, where it sits in the marketplace, you want to make everyone go away with that sentiment that says, "I want to bring my own kids back here one day." You know, we had such great experiences. That's what you leave it with. And I think that's what any operator wants their guests in the industry to leave. So I get the most excited from that. I came from a teaching and a coaching background within the ski industry, and I've always enjoyed the fact that I've been able to give knowledge that makes people have a better experience. And that's what we're doing anywhere, essentially, is where we want people to have a great and memorable experience. Everyone does. And it's good for the industry because that's what we're entertainers.
Yeah.
And we want people to have a great time. That's what they're paying to come and become immersed into that. I get really excited by that. Even though I seem to, as my managing director would say, you got any good news for me? We enjoy the challenge and the hardship because it means people end up with a great outcome. And that's why we do it. And the further you move to the top, the more the challenges you're dealing with. And that's what you bring to the table is the ability to find solutions and solve it through leadership and strategic planning, is how you stay ahead and on top. It's always a challenge, always knowing that your rides are 1 year older every year, giving you that extra headache.
I don't think we ever really get to hear this side of it. I think we arrive at a theme park and we look at the queue, the what's open, and we go, oh well, that's down, and I suppose we never really hear that there are probably reasons, like you've explained, Francis, behind all of these things that go on, not just Alton Towers. I'm also very aware, like, Disney are in that position where they have an army of people overnight that do all these things so that when magic hours hits the next morning, everything's pretty much all probably set up, ready to go. Or, that we don't have that in the UK. And so you've got more of that challenge. And it's really fascinating. I've certainly found it very interesting listening to that side of it.
Yeah, it's both an art and a science. It's the art of choreography and human management, science of engineering and logistics, but it takes strong leadership, careful planning, constant vigilance, and a whole lot of teamwork and dedication to deliver safe, fun rides day in, day out. And for the guests, understanding just a fraction of this can deepen appreciation, but that doesn't mean guests shouldn't expect excellence. And I think that's something we should all expect from whoever we're going to see, whatever attraction we're going to visit. It's great that you know about it, but really, if we're charging for it, then you should expect excellence.
I think that's what we push for as well. We often say on here, we don't think we're being unfair. We want people to go and have great days at theme parks. We all love theme parks. It's why we indulge in this hobby and this passion. And we want other people to experience it as well. And we don't want people to go to a theme park and come back and say, I had a rubbish day there. So when we, call out these things or question these things or challenge these things, it's just so that people are aware and they can go in with open eyes, or hopefully that, that parks don't get complacent and just think, oh, well, people will tolerate lower standards. So I think, Kip, you said before, death by a thousand cuts, everything slowly gets worse, and we don't quite realize we're the lobster being boiled in the water. And then before you know it, the park isn't operating anywhere near like at its best.
I think it is interesting. It does really feel like at the moment we're just kind of tolerating a lot and having to accept, well, that's just how it is now. And I think it's really sort of upsetting as enthusiasts that have been enthusiasts for as long as we are have been to sort of see this rather rapid decline. It's just sort of it really feels like the sort of the experience a lot of us have had in Merlin Parks, especially in sort of like the recent years. It just feels like it's taken a bit of a nosedive, and it's quite depressing. And I'm looking at my annual pass thinking, do I want to pay for this now? I don't really know if I want to. I'm going there and not having the days out like I used to, and it's so sad. And I'm someone who loves these places and will be vocal and support them. And yeah, it's you think the sort of Joe Public who just goes there once a year, they'll have a terrible time and they won't go back. And that's just so sad.
I'm sorry to hear that's happening, if that's how it is happening. So, I mean, what I've covered today is not just unique, I think, to the UK. I think many attractions. I envy the size of Disney and Universal. There seems to be critical mass when you get that big. But yeah, there are challenges that face the whole industry, both amusement parks and theme parks. And I hope I've given you some insight into that today.
Oh,
definitely.
Absolutely.
Yeah, you definitely have. You just mentioned Universe. Obviously, we've had the news very recently confirmed that we are getting a Universal in the UK. Does that excite you, just as someone working in the industry?
Oh, I think it's fantastic for everyone. And I'll have to say this for my old employer, Merlin. I'm sure that will be tough news to hear. But as they say, competition makes it better. So it'll be interesting to see how Merlin will step up to the plate and take that one head on. It'd be great for every enthusiast and family in the UK. That gives them another choice and more experience. And look, that brings more people into the UK to experience Universal. One would expect to see a spill of enthusiasts heading off to Alton Towers and to Thorpe Park and to Chessington to experience the Mose Merlin attractions, because it's a long way to go. So you could imagine it becomes a round trip. So it'll definitely it should drive up the guest experience.
I
I hope
know
so.
we are all really excited about it. I've got two very quick final questions for you. One of which, can you confirm or deny you're the voice of the Congo River Rapids?
Deny.
Are you sure?
It's not the first time I've heard that question, right? Wasn't expecting that
I'm just
either.
convinced it. Every time I walk past, I'm like, did Francis Jackson record this before he left?
Unless they've taken a soundbite and put it through an AI machine
Maybe.
and spat me out. Who knows? Who knows?
Can you just say, please remain seated, and then I can actually match it up and see how similar it is.
Brilliant.
Before you go as well, I've got to ask you this.
Just gotta ride it.
This is a part of the podcast called Just Gotta Ride It, where every time we have a guest on the podcast, we ask them to let us know if you could only save one roller coaster in the whole world, if everything else is going to get destroyed, which one would you save? And what are your reasons for saving it? Which one's really special to you? And it can be from any park anywhere in the world.
I'm gonna stay true to home. Smiler.
Oh, really?
Smiler. And you probably weren't expecting that
I
one.
was not
I
expecting
was
that.
expecting you to come out with some Australian gem, hidden gem that we hadn't heard about.
No, there's nothing like it. I think it sucks you in. It absolutely takes you to the limit, and it gives you a momentary pause, and then it throws you back into it again. I liken it to a ball of steel wool. I've not seen a coaster that's got such a long track in such a small confined area with so much elevation. It's a dynamite pocket rocket, and I really like it for just the surprise that it gives anybody who's done it, and the fact that it still gives you a great thrill every time you ride it.
Yeah, I have to
That
agree. So it's an engineering masterpiece, I think, just getting all that stuff in that tiny space and all those inversions, and it's sort of so constant when you're going, like you say, you get the break with the second lift hill, but then you just, yeah, I think it is quite
tense.
underrated.
Never be another one like it, I think.
It's good enough for me. I will stick it in our Just Gotta Ride It file for you with your name next to it. You can have that one. Francis, I know we've said, it's been amazing chatting to you today, but honestly, thank you so much for giving us your time. I know you're a very busy man, and I know it's probably time for your dinner in Australia. So I don't want to keep you any longer. But it's really been fascinating, and I hope anyone who's listening has learned something today, and we all have an appreciation of what's going on behind the scenes whenever we are going into a theme park.
Kev, Kip, Rebecca, fantastic. Thank you.
Thank
Thank you
you.
so much. It's been brilliant. Thank you, Francis. Really appreciate it.
It's been great. If you have enjoyed today's episode, please do leave us a little review and let us know what you thought, and if it's made you question anything or change your mind on anything. And if you subscribe to us, you'll get a notification every time we release a new episode as well. For now, though, we've been Parkcast.
Parkcast. The UK's original theme park podcast.